LibertyNation.com does not endorse candidates, campaigns, or legislation, and this presentation is no endorsement.
It's the execution of a search warrant at Donald J. Trump's home. All right now on this episode of The Uprising.
LibertyNation.com. They're the resistance, but we are The Uprising with Scott Cosenza.
Hell yes, we're going to take your AR-15.
We're in high school. I'd take you behind the gym and beat the hell out of him.
His Twitter account should be suspended.
Right. You want to go to work? Go take the job as an essential worker. Do it tomorrow.
I just don't even know why there aren't uprisings all over the country. Maybe there will be when people realize.
I think possibly that's the most unattractive form in which prejudice can be met in this country, is the rage of the entitled.
I'm high as a kite in my garage and I can see through these guys.
All right, here we go.
I've consented to a Fourth Amendment violation on myself. I can't believe I did that.
Tim, if you consent, it's not a violation. And with that, let's go ahead and start the show. Welcome back to The Uprising, LibertyNation.com's senior political analyst, Mr. Tim Donner. Tim?
Wow. I've never
from parts unknown. Was it the Bohemian Grove? Was it some meeting to keep the metric system down? We'll never know. Welcome back, though, from wherever you may have been.
You have lent new meaning to the term pregnant. Pause. Nicely done. Counselor.
Been a slow news week. Not much to talk about. Not much going on.
We could just skip the whole podcast because there's nothing important. You
know, dog days of summer, pretty much, right? That's all there is to it.
Congress is in recess.
All right. Well, I think it's going to be a single subject podcast this week on the raid of Donald Trump's home at Mar-a-Lago by the FBI. And other elements of the Justice Department. This is, there's just so much here to talk about, really.
Well, actually,
it's not going to be a single subject in the sense of the raid. It's going to be a single subject about Donald Trump, because we also had Mr. Trump testifying before Letitia James, the New York State Attorney General, in a deposition, basically, that he was ordered to give by a court in her sort of investigations into Trump writ large.
Investigation.
And he took the fifth. Right. And it's a big deal. And we're going to talk about that, too. So all in here. The raid on Mar-a-Lago. The latest, as we record now on Friday morning at just about 9:45 a.m., is that Mr. Trump is now joining the call for the release of all the documents surrounding the issuance of the search warrant for his home. Now, one of the weird kind of hiccups, why am I leading with this? I don't know. It's not the most important part about this case, but I just think it's an interesting detail about it. And there are so many in this sort of onion, is Donald Trump could release the search warrant himself or the receipt that was given to his attorney. So when a federal law enforcement officer wants a search warrant, what they do is they go to a judge. And that could be either a district court judge or a magistrate judge. In this case, it was a magistrate judge. And we're going to talk about this guy in a little bit and what we might learn about him. And they basically say, we want evidence of a certain crime that was committed. Here's the evidence. Here's the crime. And here's the evidence that we believe we will discover there. And this is why we believe that this is where we'll discover it. And those things have to be presented with basically probable cause, right? That's what the Fourth Amendment says, that warrants shall not issue except upon presentation of probable cause about the evidence and the place. So usually a warrant, and you could go look, Google yourself, just like warrant application, X circuit, whatever judicial circuit you live in, and you may find one that's posted online, and it has fill in the boxes kind of things usually for places like addresses and what one hopes to discover. And it might be, you can think of a typical Tim imaginary case. We might think of a murder case, right, where they'd hope to find a 357 Magnum revolver, and they expect to find it in a container in the house that can contain that firearm, because it's you know, the person murdered their business partner, right? And that's what's suspected of it. And then the cops can go, and then they can search anything in that residence generally that might contain a 357 Magnum, or typically a search warrant might include, for instance, ammunition that might fit in a 357 Magnum, right? Or gun cleaning kits or something else to indicate that there was a gun there, you know, the sort of ancillary things, right? And so typically how that's worded is the judge or magistrate will say, it's basically a judicial order. It's not a permission slip. It's not a judge, Tim, saying, okay, you, Agent Tim Donner, may go to Mar-a-Lago and collect these things. Once the probable cause is actually seen to by the court, then it's an order. It's a mandate. The judge says, Tim Donner, go to this address, seize these items, and return them to this court. And that's sort of how it all works. But Trump could release this warrant, and he's not. He's asked for the release of all these surrounding documents around it, which may be interesting. But the warrant itself is something, and the receipt. So I think I stepped on my own story by going off on a tangent. I apologize. You've been very patiently listening to me, Tim. But the two things that are generally presented at the issuance of the warrant is the warrant itself upon the arrival of the officers, and then when they leave, a receipt document that says, here's what we took. And Trump could release those things now. I don't know why he hasn't, but Merrick Garland, of course, asked the court to release its own warrant, which is under seal, and we're waiting to see if they'll do that. I suspect they will.
Well, I've got a
yeah, that was a lot to chew on.
Boatload of questions, of course.
You know, before we get to your question, let's do this real quick. Let's just play Christina Bob, Trump's lawyer on the warrant issue.
President Trump's attorney, Christina Bob, who was at Mar-a-Lago during the raid. Christina, nice to see you. It's been a long time. Will the president and his team object to unsealing the search warrant and the evidence recovered?
It doesn't appear at this time like we would object, but the court has ordered the Department of Justice to coordinate with us and to work on, you know, how that release would take place or what that would look like. Our team has responded. We have reached out to the Department of Justice to coordinate that and have not been able to make contact. So we're waiting to hear back from them, and we're very eager. I mean, we know that people want information, and we're eager to respond as best as possible in coordination with the Department of Justice. So we're just waiting to hear back from them.
Okay, well, you guys have a copy of the warrant, and you're given a receipt at the end of an FBI search warrant. Why wouldn't you just release that yourselves?
Well, this is part of the discussion with the Department of Justice. Of course, we're trying to do everything in accordance with the law and
There's absolutely nothing preventing you guys from releasing it, though.
Other than decorum, I mean, we're trying to work well with the Department of Justice. We've been cooperative this entire time, and we'd like to remain cooperative, and we have reached out to them and are waiting to hear back.
So, Scott, I mean, there's a myriad of questions here, but again, not necessarily trying to do it in order of importance.
No, it's hard to. It's a podcast.
Because all these things.
Let's just have at it.
I mean, because here's the thing. The trouble is we still don't really know much of anything.
All right. So what we know.
Except the fact that they were raided. But let me ask you this.
Yeah.
Since you you started by talking about, schooling our listeners and viewers on a warrant. We hear reports which have not been denied that they went into Melania's closet, okay, and went through her personal items, that they busted open a safe. So here's my question.
Sure.
When a warrant is issued, does that mean, and it's a bit of a rhetorical question, does that mean that they can, the 30 or 40 agents from the FBI can go in and go anywhere they want?
Well, if we think about the example I gave earlier about the gun, they could, for instance, go anywhere where they could hide a gun, right? So if you have a piece of Tupperware that is large enough that it could contain a firearm, then they can go inside.
So what you're saying is that, yes, essentially once they go in, they can go anywhere they want.
The warrant itself would be very specific with what evidence they're looking for, okay?
But they can look for it any place.
Anywhere within the confines of the warrant. Right. Usually it will specify a physical address. It'll say, you know, 1212 Mockingbird Lane, right? And that defines where, and they can search with anywhere within that
residence. The Adams family.
Is that right? Did I unconsciously?
Or was it the Munsters they lived in? No, it was 1313 Mockingbird Lane.
There you go.
So essentially what you're saying is they can provide justification for going in anywhere. That they might find an item like in the middle of one of Melania's shoes, for example. Okay. Now, here's a question. When this information is released, the warrant has very limited information. It just provides a specific instructions, right?
Well, it would actually specify, Tim, the evidence to be seized.
Mm-hmm.
So that's part of what the warrant would say.
What about the affidavit?
Now we're talking about a different thing altogether.
But that's what leads to the warrant.
Let me just give a Scotia background on that. So the warrant itself is... the judge issues the warrant. And like I said, the warrant says, go to this address and seize this evidence and bring it back here. The affidavit in support of the warrant application is where all the good stuff is.
Right.
That's where it says, so-and-so told us this is over here and this is what he did with it. And this is why we want to go get it. Okay. That's where all the meat is. And we're probably never going to see that an unredacted copy of it, especially if it includes, as we're being led to believe by this Newsweek story, namely that has two confidential sources. One of them is described, I think, as a 25-plus-year FBI employee. That this involves, you know, basically a member of Trump's team telling on him, or as a confidential informant to the DOJ regarding this matter. That's what we're led to believe.
They seem to believe that it's someone in Secret Service, but that's just a report.
Could be.
Now, here's the problem.
So we're probably never going to see an unredacted version of that affidavit of probable cause, but we'll see something if Trump's legal team releases it. So the warrant itself, warrant application and all that stuff, DOJ does, as a matter of course, does not release these things. It's not like you can just go some random criminal case and read that stuff. But the defense team may release it.
Okay, so let me address the Newsweek story, because you made a couple references to it. The problem with that,
and I wrote about it for this week in the pages of the sponsor of today's program, Tim, LibertyNation.com, the listener and viewer source for conservatarian news and analysis 24/7.
And you made several citations in that article to the Newsweek article. Now, the problem is, and this is what happens when something that you hear from a confidential source is wrong, then you have to question all the rest of it.
Agreed.
Part of the Newsweek story was that Merrick Garland did not know about this.
Yeah.
Did not authorize it. And then Garland said he did. So I wonder about the Newsweek story and its accuracy, because it's a pretty critical
error. You're right, too. But I would say that, if, as I recall the Newsweek story, that was kind of, and you might say, well, that's crazy, Scott, that you would say this, but that bit of information was almost a sideline. In other words, of who knew what and when. They were less
sideline.
I accurately predicted your reaction. My point is that if you read the piece, the way that information was presented, it wasn't with the firmness of I think they kind of soft pedaled that part of the article. But you're right. I'm not disputing it. I don't think that we shouldn't. And we should take it skeptically.
I was shocked. I mean, because frankly, Scott, I was shocked when Garland got up there on Thursday and said, I personally authorized it. I said to myself, wait a minute. For the last 48 hours, we proceeded under the assumption from this Newsweek article and maybe somewhere else that Garland knew nothing about it.
So I made two conjectures in my piece, and it was largely devoid of conjecture, unlike so much of the other coverage that we've seen on this. But I did make two points of conjecture, both of which I think have come true. One is that they talked to their superiors about it because there's no way in hell that some junior, and that was kind of also featured by the art. It was like an AUSA. Tim, I know some AUSAs, and the idea that they would authorize without checking with at least the U.S. attorney they work under the search of a former president's residence is beyond the pale. Absolutely. And the other thing is that that they did it while he was away, that so that, you know, they removed the possibility of the story about it being them searching while he was there, which would have been an order of magnitude even more outrageous, fantastic, you know, whatever you want to use, the blockbuster kind of a news, because that may have involved him actually being detained and cuffed, as often is the case, sort of when they go in for you know, initial part of a search warrant is lock everybody down. Now, Trump has Secret Service protection, so maybe you might say, well, that would never happen. I don't know. That would be another unprecedented part of this.
Well, let me ask you this question, because this has been uppermost in my mind in terms of questions since I heard about the raid. Nobody seems to dispute the fact that Trump's attorneys were cooperating with federal authorities. Now, I don't know if it was full cooperation or if they possibly acted as if they were cooperating while they were concealing some things. But isn't it highly unusual, not even just for a former president, but for anybody, when he has a battery of lawyers cooperating with federal authorities and they still feel the need to send 30 to 40 FBI agents in and then kick out the lawyers while they're searching the premises?
All right. Well, just to your last point, or your last little bit there first, just because I part of the things that I would like to do is kind of dispel notions that are wrong or not based in our law or traditions. And while searching authorities may grant the subject of a search's attorney access to the facility while they're searching it,
like,
that's not unheard of.
I understand.
It's far from but not everybody does. It's
well,
far
that
from
was okay. That was an aside for me.
I get it. I just wanted to address it. I think it's part of. Yeah. I think part of what the value for the podcast can be is to address some of these tertiary points, which is, and that's not usually how a search warrant goes. It's not usually done that a person's lawyer would be present at a warrant execution, and it's certainly not required by any rule or notion, or even just sort of like, well, everybody knows that's how it's done. No, that's not the case. It may occur, but also plenty of times nobody's allowed to look at a search, and so that part is just not normal. And you know, they say that you know, maybe they planted something. I think Trump said something along those lines. Look,
you can always claim
nothing's impossible, but I think that it's probably highly unlikely that went on.
However, if he says it, a lot of his supporters will believe it, just like so many of his supporters, probably 100% and maybe 95% of Republicans believe that Biden had to have known about it. And the White House has said, we knew nothing.
Yeah.
They did the Sergeant Schultz thing.
I would not be surprised if they didn't know about it. I really wouldn't. I think that Biden has given them their marching orders. I think that Merrick Garland knows exactly that Biden wants the maximum. To me, it's very clear. If I were the attorney general, like this is.
Well, then he's essentially has given him his marching orders.
Yes.
I mean, you just answered the question.
Now,
did he know about this specific raid?
Right. No.
Perhaps not.
Yeah. So I think he doesn't need to.
Is it not a serious problem for the American political system when a former president is being served on his home.
Yeah.
And the sitting president doesn't know anything about it.
Well,
that seems either unlikely or unsafe.
I think it's probably, I think it is likely to me. So I'll say that for you anyway, it's unsafe. It makes sense to me that he wouldn't, in terms of even in a functioning system, it actually makes sense.
Plausible.
But let's just put the brakes on all that for a second and let me get back to the meat of your of your question. I pulled out that one little thread from the end of it to answer about
the
lawyer present. Oh, and by the way, I saw some chatter too about, you know, they kind of broke into one of his safes. They had a safe cracker there. And people were kind of like, they can do that, you know, surprised at that. Like, there might be some extra protection or something like that. There is none. How this would work in a non, you know, past president of the United States, just John Q. businessman. The FBI goes to their house to look for evidence of embezzlement or whatever, and there's a safe there. They say, you can either open that safe or we'll break it open and take what's inside and look at what's inside. It's your choice, you know. So you get the option to either open it for them or have them break it open. That's the sort of everyday humdrum way that works. So, all right. Now, what was the actual
question was about, yeah. If it is customary for a subject of investigation for his lawyers, his battery of lawyers to be cooperating.
Oh, excuse me. Thank you. Okay. Yeah.
And that's still
right.
They get raided.
All right. So as I understand that, and like so much of this understanding is based on major media outlets discussing things that they say are released, you know, basically their contacts in these agencies. So leaks by people who they claim are DOJ officials or FBI officials. So there's the Wall Street Journal leak and the Newsweek. Those are the two big ones. I think Politico had a third. But so my understanding, Tim, is that that process was going on, that cooperation process of, you know, okay, you can come and look. And they said, put another lock on that door. And he did it, apparently. And all that was
hunky-dory. And he turned over, did he?
No. Yeah, they took some boxes, apparently.
They turned over 15
something like
boxes,
that,
according to most of the news reports.
But here's the thing, and this
they
is
had
what,
already done it. In other words, they had.
This was like a month at least ago, or something like that.
15 boxes, right? Okay.
But here's the big deal. Apparently, again, according to these confidential sources, right? What the person next to Trump said, the person in his inner circle, their confidential informant,
right,
was that he lied about apparently the breadth of the documents that he had. And so therefore, you can't cooperate in bad faith, Tim. And I'm not saying he did it, but that's the allegation here.
Well, that would explain
so that there was cooperation, but it was in bad faith. And when the bad faith was discovered and the extent to which it was discovered, that's what prompted the raid.
Okay. That actually makes more sense than any explanation I've heard yet. In other words, he was cooperating. So you say, well, wait a minute, he's cooperating.
Right.
But it's such a serious game-changing Rubicon crossing move to raid a former president that you'd think, even if you have no confidence in the officials of this administration, you'd think they couldn't be so reckless as to go in just because it was Trump and they wanted to expedite the process of cooperation by taking the stuff off their hands. So I'm not saying what you said is true, but it would make more sense than anything I've heard yet.
Yeah. And that could be a sort of apolitical way to approach the analysis of it.
Right.
You know, this is one of those things where there are the facts that we can establish, and then there's sort of the things with which we kind of prejudices and opinions that we come to the table with. You know, you talk about the sort of political implications of it. There's another thing, which is that, you know, if I call the police and I say that somebody's driving 56 miles an hour down the road and there's a 55 mile an hour speed limit, the police, they probably can't even have enough energy to laugh at me. They're not going to send anybody out to investigate it. They're not going to do anything about it, right? Mm-hmm. But if I say that there's somebody driving 56 and it's so-and-so that I know the police don't like, and they put out a squad of helicopters and undercovers and, you know, people in manholes to discover the speed, and then when it's 56, they pounce on the person like they're, you know,
it's like Al Capone for tax evasion, Right.
Yeah, well,
how many people that he murdered, but they got him for tax evasion.
Yeah. By the way, that all that shows you is don't violate the nation's tax laws, and, because they're serious about getting their money, Tim.
Especially with 87,000 new IRS agents.
Maybe we'll talk about that.
Hired over the next 10 years.
Maybe we'll talk about that next week. But so that could be like an apolitical way, you know, to look at it. You know, there's another possibility too, and I'll just throw it out there because I have the thought is they're dealing with one team of prosecutors in D.C. maybe, and then there's like a miscommunication about a South Florida prosecution team. It could be, by the way. You know, these are just the sort of things where, like, gee, Scott, do you really think that happened with the
local the FBI
president of the United States? And I would just say, don't underestimate the potential for incompetence, even as we, you know, think that that's probably not likely.
Yeah, I mean, my understanding is that the local field office of the FBI didn't even know about the raid. In other words, the one closest in the region of Mar-a-Lago was not even informed, wasn't told. Nobody was told, basically, except Trump and his lawyers, as I understand it. And it's remarkable how they kept this thing quiet beforehand. And then it was 12 hours after the raid at 6:30 in the morning. We didn't hear till 6:30 in the evening.
Yeah, there was actually one Florida political blogger type who tweeted it out. And I don't think he had the reach, you know, for other people to pick up on it. I think most folks heard about it from Trump himself, which was another thing that was kind of interesting. I kept trying to get confirmation about it from some source other than Trump to understand, you know, what was going
on. My next question or concern, and this is more a discussion between two people speculating rather than it being a legal question necessarily. They're dropping the N-word now, and I don't mean the N-word we usually talk about. I'm talking about nuclear, that they're talking about nuclear.
Oh, right. That was that the
nuclear
the focus
papers,
of the documents.
Nuclear information, nuclear secrets, perhaps, that I'm wondering if that's really the basis for the raid, or if they feel like they can neutralize the coverage.
Well, you know, the funny thing is
nuclear. So people go, thank God they went in.
The funny thing
is, because maybe he
you
was
can imagine the most
nuclear bomb.
You can imagine the most sensitive information about our nuclear arsenal or about nuclear weaponry is the actual mechanics of it, how they work. They're like systems and stuff, like schematics and diagrams. Like that would be the thing that a spy would most want to have access to so they could be replicated or learn how to defeat them. Of all the things that I imagine Trump would have, that would be like the last thing ever, like an actual schematic of the physical device of a nuclear device. Right. So almost certainly if it is a thing about nuclear issues, it would be a discussion of maybe how many or where they're located or agreements with other nations, perhaps. But I agree that, look, that is the one thing where you might expect. You know, the other thing you could do is like it's about child trafficking, or like, you know, what would be the most the you know, the topic or thing that you could release that would be, you know, people would be most sympathetic about saying, oh yeah, well then it's then that's worth it, or then that makes sense that it was about that thing, right?
Do you expect an indictment here, and if so, when would you think it's most likely to come down?
All right, so let's talk about one other thing, which is that according to that Newsweek piece, there is a grand jury impaneled to examine this violation of the federal law, this Presidential Records Act.
Mm-hmm.
And they have already decided that there was a violation of the law.
Of course, it's not a criminal statute. I think that's important to point out. The Presidential Records Act is not a criminal statute, nor have the violations of it been punished at all severely.
Well, one of the penalties for violating the law is removal or the inability to run for office. So that may or may not be a criminal penalty. It's interesting, right? There's no incarceral or carceral consequence potential, but that in and of itself, you know, these things haven't been litigated out like, oh, everybody knows this is how the courts would decide on that.
Right.
I'd be curious to see. They may say it's non-justiciable, which is when courts really don't want to get involved in a question they think is political, they just say, "Oh, well, we can't. Well, we don't know about that." You know, right. you all figure that out yourselves.
Right. Talk amongst yourselves.
But you know, that's one of the kind of suppositions of the pro-Trump skeptical types online that, you know, I'm hearing, hey, this is about that. This is about getting Donald Trump to not run for president. And you can't take away, number one, that the guy was president when you sort of examine these things. And number two, he is the most likely number one contender to take the job away from Joe Biden. That's sort of the other thing where, you know, it's funny because it seemed like the Justice Department wasn't going to say anything. And then I don't know if you saw this, but on Thursday morning, there was a New York Times op-ed that basically said, you need to, you know, come clean with the American people and discuss what this was about, Merrick Garland. And then there you go, 2 o'clock in the afternoon, they get their marching orders, you know, Merrick Garland.
It's the E.F. Hutton thing when the New York Times speaks. Yeah. The administration listens.
And by the way, just an aside, what I think to be a fly on a wall, he kept everybody waiting for half an hour. They tweeted it out at like 2 o'clock, I think. And for the people who were,
they were 35 minutes late. Yeah, I'm sitting there waiting for the live announcement.
Tim, you and three other of the LibertyNation.com rapid response team to get this information published, we're all waiting on Mr. Garland. So anyway, what was going on during that half hour? What words were they fighting over?
Oh my
what
goodness.
Sentences were
I can't
the,
even imagine.
You know?
You knew it was a tortured statement.
Yeah.
Which, you know, was just
I think it's good that he made it, though, by the way, for the country. I think it's very good to have a wall of silence in the face of the surge of a former president and contender to the White House's.
There's a big problem with that, though, which is that conspiracy theorists and legitimate people on both sides are spinning the story their own way with no information. The left says this is about time that they crack down on this criminal.
Yeah.
And the right says they're persecuting him again. And both can speculate about the information that backs up their case, but there's no hard information, which is why this is so troubling, because you're going to get narratives. You're already seeing them, of course. Narratives on the left, narratives on the right. This is awful. This is great. Without any real hard information, except that there was a warrant, that Attorney General Merrick Garland approved it, and he did say the one thing, little tiny morsel that he sort of gave, which is boilerplate, as I understand, for warrants. But he said, we do this when it's not possible to obtain what we need any other way. So that did speak to what you were saying, that there was something or things being withheld.
Or a breakdown of communication or something. But
Possibly.
And we also know that Mr. Ray approved of the warrant. That's according to the Newsweek sources, FBI director. Who
of course, what the left is doing is they're saying, well, follow the logic. Christopher Ray, FBI director, he was appointed by Trump. Therefore, if he authorized the raid as a Trump guy, it must really be bad.
Yeah, I don't know that he's a Trump guy. I know that he was appointed by him.
Well, no, they make it seem that he is because he was appointed by Trump. So therefore, if he goes after Trump with this warrant, wow, he must really have something big. Again, that's idle speculation. And on the right, you're hearing people say, you know, that they probably planted evidence that they...
Oh, all manner of...
So there's all kinds of... And these things take root when there's no hard information or indictment. So the more time goes by, the worse this is going to get,
you know,
because we're not going to get information.
There's one detail that kind of, I think, is quite peculiar is... So there's this notion that... not this notion. There's this statement that... from these inside sources that it was a source very close to Trump that gave them the information of the precise information the evidence that they were seeking and where it was located. Okay. Mm-hmm. But they spent 9 hours at the property.
Exactly.
So if I tell you that Professor Plum did it in the library with the candlestick holder and that the candlestick holder is in a garden box out by a shed, that's where he hid it on his way off the property. And you go, what are you doing for 9 hours there? What are you doing for 9 hours? You know, so part of these things don't add up.
It's called a fishing expedition.
Maybe. Well, let's talk about that for a second. I think that's really important to talk about that because that's one of the things that people have been saying. Mm-hmm. And so there's an important term here, which is a pretextual. As a pretext. And if you've ever watched like the show Cops or see these YouTube videos of police officers that are looking for like drugs, for instance, what they'll often do is they'll follow somebody on the road for, you don't have to follow them long. It's impossible to basically obey all traffic laws all the time. So somebody will get a skosh too close to the center line or whatever it might be, right? Hit their brakes a nanosecond too late or too early. The cops pull them over. Boom. Oh, I noticed you were, you know, such and such. Yeah, okay, let me see your license. Oh, okay. And where are you headed today? Oh, what do you got in the back? Oh, who's your friend here? You know, the stop, they don't care about the speed or the lane violation. It's a pretext to get access to the person to discover their identity and to get involved in their business. And once the cops have that pretext done, according to the courts, they're legally able to then do all kinds of things. So if you're legally able to get into Melania's shoe closet, okay, because you have a warrant that allows you to search for nuclear blah, blah, blah information. But what you really want is January 6th, some communication that you're hoping will.
Gee, look what we found.
Exactly. Amid Melania's underthings, I happened to discover X, Y, and Z, right? And I was allowed to go there because of this warrant. Well,
that would be strange too, Scott, because what would there be in writing about January 6th?
No. That he would, by the way, it would be strange, but I'm explaining the
whole. No, I understand. Yeah, the press. But I've heard that said, too.
Yeah.
And it's legitimate to think, oh, look, the coincidence and the timing, this is right after.
It's like he's got like an autographed QAnon shaman 8x10 in his, like, you know, in his dressing area that says,
but
like,
I mean, it's okay.
Thanks for all the help, Donnie.
This is almost equidistant between the end of the first part of the January 6th show trial and the second part in September. So, again, without any hard information.
Wait, they're going to do a second season so close?
Yes, right.
I didn't even know that.
Well, it was so popular, Scott, that it came back by popular demand.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, without any hard information or an indictment, people are free to speculate in this direction, right? So they've opened up a can of worms that beyond just the former president, but to the point of taking a divided nation and inviting them essentially to choose up sides even more fiercely about this.
Absolutely.
Incident, which again, we don't have.
I can
have
tell you that my candid,
information about.
My candid reaction was, and I don't want to react this way for so many reasons, was to be in defense of Donald Trump and to think this was an outrage perpetrated by an FBI that was, it is so politicized now that it can't be unpoliticized at that level, at the highest levels. And that's sort of what my thought it just goes for. Like, you know, even if he did break the law, that's the kind of thing. I actually had an argument with a family member who's a never Trumper type person. And, you know, they were arguing that Trump probably violated this law, this presidential whatever records, you know, act. And I just thought to them, or I said to them, you know, what if he did? Is it worth tearing the country apart to prosecute him for it? You know, decisions to prosecute him are political decisions. That includes all sorts of prosecutions and law enforcement officers and agencies and prosecutorial agencies around this country make triage decisions all the time. Okay. Johnny stole a candy bar from the 7-Eleven. Do they haul him before the criminal courts and do it? Well, if they do, that's a problem because they shouldn't be, you know, expanding the resources that way. But you've got an almost unlimited supply of crimes to choose to deal with, right?
Exactly.
Think about the number of like identity theft crimes that go on in America that like nobody talks about. You don't even bother.
I mean, it's what you would call discretionary prosecution, because there's millions of crimes being committed literally every day. So it's all a matter of who they choose to target.
And if you choose to target Donald Trump for going 56 miles an hour in a 55 mile an hour zone, and you never target any of the other drivers on the road who do the same thing, well, especially coming off of a manufactured charge of treason by our nation's highest and most respected law enforcement and intelligence sources, right? That's what we had. It's, you know, the Russia
collusion
stuff, right?
Lasted for 3 years.
To then come off of that into this,
what do you expect Trump's believers?
There's a more
Trump
extraordinary burden. They've built in for themselves an extraordinary burden that they have to then overcome, I think.
Have to prove themselves innocent, in a sense.
I think you're right about that. Yeah,
because their persecution of Trump has been so real that, and even on the left, they have to admit that he's was persistently, consistently persecuted.
Well, let's talk about that for a second.
Presidency. So what would you expect Trump supporters to believe? Would they say, would you expect anybody, even any Republican, to say, I think the FBI must have had good reason. And I'm sure since James Comey's gone, it's a totally non-political. Yeah. No, I don't think Trump supporters believe that. So
let's use the example of Letitia James. I think that this is helpful in terms of what they're up against. This is a campaign ad that she's the Attorney General of New York. No, I think she's replaced Carl Racine as being the most political of the attorneys general in our country, Tim, that just seems to be willing to use the office to further her political goals rather than, you know, worry about, for instance, identity theft or any other of the ways that, you know, New Yorkers are being taken advantage of. She's the one who tried to end the NRA. Because why? Because of corruption at the top of, so she alleged that the top half a dozen people at a million member organization were fleecing their members, and the fix for that was to extinguish the organization.
Well,
in
she's
its entirety.
Protecting the membership of the innocent membership of the NRA. Scott, I don't know how you could object to that.
All right, so this was a campaign ad that she ran, or this is a compilation of some campaign remarks that she had. That Trump posted on his social media.
Will you sue him for us?
Oh, we're going to definitely sue him. We're going to be a real pain in the ass.
I will never be afraid to challenge this illegitimate president.
We need to focus on Donald Trump. We need to follow his money.
What is fueling my soul right now is Trump.
This illegitimate president. I look forward to going into the office of Attorney General every day, suing him, and then going home.
So that's what Trump's facing against in New York. This attorney general who basically took office with a promise to go get Donald Trump. And she spent the 3 years that she's been in office trying to get Donald Trump. He finally has to go along with his, daughter and son-in-law to go and submit to this examination by Ms. James and her seconds. And what does he do? He takes the Fifth. And then he has to kind of announce that he's taken the Fifth to his followers because it's perceived as, you know, guilty people do that, especially, I think, among conservatives, you know.
Well, there's the presumption. Look, we know, and you'll probably reiterate here, that taking the Fifth does not equate to admitting guilt, but it's equally true that a great majority of people consider a person guilty if they take the Fifth. But that's a public perception as opposed to an actual
legal. We have to get into the nuance here just a little bit, because also, you know, you mentioned that the Records Act is not a criminal law. Letitia James' investigation is not a criminal legal investigation. It may have implications for crimes, but hers is a civil law investigation where Trump may have to pay money damages and his businesses could suffer, maybe, you know, not being able to continue to do business in New York, for instance.
Right.
But the reason why that's important is because when he takes the Fifth, Tim, in the civil matter, she could actually sue Trump in court. And then if she does, she's allowed to present to a jury that he took the Fifth so that it may be used against him in the civil
in
part.
A civil case.
It could never be used against him in a criminal trial. And those careful watchers of the Kyle Rittenhouse trial remember, I'm sure, that Judge Bruce Schrader kind of went ballistic on Thomas Binger, who was the prosecuting attorney. And Binger said, you know, basically, you waited all this time to say something, meaning he waited all this time from the incident until his testimony in court, which basically was commenting about him remaining silent. And it was a huge thing. And many legal observers, including myself, thought that would have been sufficient to grant a mistrial because it's so verboten for, you know, to allow the government to comment on it, precisely because, Tim, you're right, that people do think and they shouldn't think that it makes the most sense possible. And the only good legal instruction is to instruct people to not comment because of what it may mean for other matters. And don't take my word for it. Take James Duane, who's a law professor, and listen to what he has. This is worth its weight in gold here for anybody listening.
Here's the easiest question you'll ever get from a client in all the days of your life. Question, hey, the police are here. They want to talk to me. What should I do? Well, I could give you my answer to that question in case you haven't already guessed it, but why don't we go to a real expert? Justice Robert Jackson, a prosecutor's prosecutor. Like me, he began his private practice in Buffalo, New York, years before I did. And after that, he served as general counsel for the Bureau of Internal Revenue, the U.S. Department of Treasury, the Security and Exchange Commission, assistant U.S. Attorney General for the Tax Division, later the Solicitor General and the Attorney General of the United States, and then the chief U.S. prosecutor for the Nuremberg trials. That's an impressive resume. Years later, when he was a justice on the Supreme Court, Justice Jackson stated, quote, any lawyer worth his salt, today we would say his or her, will tell the suspect, his client, in no uncertain terms to make no statement to the police under any circumstances. There's the title of my talk. I'm here to explain to you the surprising and somewhat counterintuitive and admittedly unlikely reasons why Justice Jackson was right. I'm reminded of this because I'm amazed, we're all amazed, by the frequency with which we see newspaper articles coming out all the time from people who really ought to know better, who say, well, I'll talk to the police. I mean, after all, I'm a senator. I'm O.J. Simpson. I'm an experienced, highly polished individual. I've got a lot of experience with public relations, even criminal defense attorneys. There was a local news story here in the Virginia Pilot just a couple of months ago about an experienced criminal defense lawyer who ended up getting convicted of criminal assault because he talked to the police. He was accused of having assaulted another attorney in the hallway. There were no other witnesses to this. A woman said that he grabbed her by the throat during an argument over a case. He denied it. At trial, it was his word against hers. He said, I did not even touch her. But unfortunately for him, when the police had approached him earlier and said, would you be willing to answer some questions? He said, sure, why not? I'm an attorney. I'm a criminal defense attorney. I'm savvy. I'm sophisticated. I've got oratorical prowess. I'm accustomed to dealing with the police, by all means. And then there was a conversation that was not recorded. When the case went to trial, it was no longer his word against hers, because when he testified at trial, I never touched her. The officer took her to the stand and testified, well, when I met with him, he said he did put his hand on her throat, but just as a joke. Then he had to take the stand again and say, that's not true. I never said that. I never admitted to you that I... Now it's his word against two people. Who's telling the truth? We'll never know for sure. But he was found guilty. Now, here's part of the problem. The heart of the problem, as Justice Breyer on the U.S. Supreme Court explained in 1998, is, quote, the complexity of modern federal criminal law codified in several thousand sections of the United States Code and the virtually infinite variety of factual circumstances that might trigger an investigation into a possible violation of the law make it difficult for anyone to know in advance just when a particular set of statements might later appear to a prosecutor to be relevant to some investigation. One expert on criminal law recently noted that estimates of the current size of the body of federal criminal law vary, although it has been reported that the Congressional Research Service can no longer even count the current number of federal crimes. That's right. Even the federal government has lost count. These laws are scattered over all 50 pages of the U.S. Code, encompassing roughly 27,000 pages. Worse yet, these statutes often incorporate by reference to the provisions of administrative regulations. Estimates of how many such regulations exist are even less well settled, although the ABA thinks there may be nearly 10,000.
So, yeah, don't say a damn thing if you're if you're ever in the situation.
That's a very practical piece of advice.
Yeah, you're not more clever than they are. You're not going to figure it out.
Well, I think the most common thing that people go off the rails is they say, sure, I'll talk to the cops. I haven't done anything wrong.
Yeah.
That's
I encourage everybody to watch that full lecture. It's called Don't Talk to the Police. And he actually has a police officer on the lecture who says some things. But one of the things I'm just recalling from the lecture, one of the examples he gives is, you know, you're accused of killing XYZ person in Washington, D.C., Tim, you know, last week. And you say, I wasn't even in Washington, D.C. last week, right? But somebody you know was in Washington, D.C., and they testify that you were there. Now, they don't testify that you were part of a murder, and maybe they're even mistaken, because I happen to know that you weren't in our nation's capital last week. But maybe they were mistaken. And their mistaken belief can put you then in the jackpot for being a liar and then, of course, maybe ultimately being convicted. The point is, and there's another thing, too, that this is kind of, I think, never really explained for people. And so that's part of the reason fueling why they think it's okay to talk is when the police say anything you say can and will be used against you in a court of law. One of the kind of things that they should add to that is anything that you say cannot be used to help you in a court. OK, so people sometimes think, oh, well, I'll say I didn't do it and then that can be used to help me. Right. But the rules of evidence say that hearsay is inadmissible, generally speaking. But there are some exceptions to the hearsay rule. And one of the exceptions is a statement against interest. So if you say something against your own interests, that's going to be able to come into court. But if it's not against your own interest,
you can't,
if it buoys your interest, right. Okay, if it backs your claim, it's never coming in. So that's part of the reason why you just, you know, like he says, and I kept that part and I love that part in the beginning. The easiest question you ever get, could get as a lawyer, you know, the police are here and they say they want to talk to you. What should I do? Don't talk to them. Easy answer.
One word, you know, answer.
Yeah. If they wanted to arrest you, they would. So, all right, let's go ahead and just go pure political for a minute. We're you know, getting to the end of the show here, and I do want to talk about it. It seems like this is all going to accrue to Donald Trump's benefit. We've seen, I mean, even Andrew Cuomo kind of put out a you could call it a pro-Trump message almost, you know, recognizing the importance of it, and everybody.
But you also had never Trumpers. Like Maryland Governor Larry Hogan is one example, who were outraged by this. This will consolidate his support. It will make it harder for a guy like DeSantis or Ted Cruz to get the nomination. It changes the whole equation, because now Trump is seen in a different light as a martyred figure.
That's what it is. It's a martyring of him
in many people's minds.
That's a good analysis. Yeah.
Yeah. So here,
at least at the present moment, you know, obviously, could it changed him? Could it, if he had this, you know, if he had the nuclear codes in some folder and he said he didn't want to give them up with those people?
Certainly it could. But again, there's the problem of people building up these huge extended narratives without any information. But here's the bottom line, which I think is not going to be encouraging to conservatives. This whole incident makes Trump more likely to win the nomination and less likely to win the general election.
Interesting.
That's how I view it, because the people that are behind Trump and Republicans, they're going to consolidate and support. Many people will now support him just on general principle, because they feel he was.
Well, a lot of people that were trying to distance themselves from Donald Trump, they have to kind of, you know,
they have to reconsider.
I mean, it's one of those things where if the attack, you know, brothers can disagree, right? But when the stranger comes along and threatens the other brother, you got to rally to your brother's defense, right or wrong. It's sort of how we're programmed, right? Sort of a tribal thing. And so while they were fighting it out internally, maybe, you know, the Trumpers and the anti-Trumpers in the Republican Party, when the when the attacks come from outside, well, they're going to rally everybody up. And that's where we are.
Okay. I have completely, can you hear me? Okay. My whole system went,
I saw it went black. Yeah.
Ooh, yeah. That was weird. Then I got like,
all right, let's just continue. Stretch. We don't need to, you're good. You're fine.
So anyway, this changes the bidding for 2024. As of now, because it means, on the one hand, he is certainly more likely to win his third straight Republican presidential nomination. But on the other hand, the people who were on the fence, they see him being raided, and the people who said, I can just see another 4 years of constant turmoil with Trump, constant controversy.
Right.
Here we go again.
Interesting.
And I think that makes a general election of voting base or voters in general in the general election less likely to vote for him, especially if there is something of a truly nefarious nature that was supposed to be hidden by him or whatever. But at the same time, if there isn't adequate explanation provided for the need to commit this unprecedented act, then it might accrue to Trump's general benefit in a general election campaign, because people, you know, I think people are just very uncomfortable.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, look, you have
it's hard to know what's worse for the country and what's better for the country, that he actually did do something really bad or that he didn't. You know, right. Did he really conceal something that is a danger to us all for his having concealed it? Or is it a paperwork crime, or is it not a crime at all? Yeah, it's
here's the topic. I'm in the middle of writing it now. It's going to run on Saturday on LibertyNation.com. The question,
Tim, you let me do the LibertyNation.com.
Well, I'm imitating you. Imitation is a sincerest form of flattery.
All right.
I never said it like that before the uprising.
I mean, you know, I got to protect my turf here. I got certain.
But the title of the piece to go up on LibertyNation.com on Saturday is, do Democrats in their heart of hearts really want Trump in or out for 2024, because you could make an equal case for both sides. On the one hand, they want him out because they consider him a danger to the Republic. They consider him to be more than repugnant. They consider him to be essentially Hitler. So they want him out. On the other hand, considering their own president right now is in the 30s in approval, job approval, they want the easiest possible opponent in 2024, because Biden, if he runs again, it's a really weak ticket. If Kamala Harris runs, it's even weaker, and there's no evident successor to the as Democratic nominee. So especially given all of that, they would want a guy who was the easiest to beat. And even many Republicans believe that Trump could never be elected president again after what happened with January 6th and the end of his term. So on the one hand, they want him out at all costs and would like to make it so he can't even run again. On the other hand, might he not be easier to beat than Ron DeSantis, because DeSantis carries the whole Trump message without the Trump baggage? See what I'm saying?
I do. I think it's an interesting question that, you know, I mean, it was an interesting question before all this, you know,
yes,
whether or not, what, you know, what would happen with those schisms inside the mm-hmm. Republican Party to me. You know, I wanted to talk, I was going to send us home and call it a day after that discussion of the political parts, but I forgot that I wanted to talk about the judge for a second.
I have something really curious to ask.
Sure. Good.
As a legal expert, because nobody's given me a satisfactory answer.
Well, let's see if I can
you can try.
Summon the will. Yeah.
How did Judge Reinhold go from a really good young actor to
all right.
a magistrate way, you know, judge?
That
judge
guy, Reinhold. That guy kind of fell off the face of the,
yeah, he did.
Of the map, didn't he?
But I remembered him.
He was in every movie for like yes. 10 years, right?
Yes. He was one of those.
Yeah.
He had a spurt and then nobody heard from him again. Judge Reinhold.
Yeah.
So he's back. Maybe he'll be experiencing a renaissance of his career.
So this guy, Reinhold, and of course, I appreciate the joke, but his name's Bruce, I think, right?
I think so.
And
if it isn't, it should be. If you
he
look
actually
at him, he looks
is,
like a Bruce.
He is a magistrate judge. And the difference between a district court judge and a magistrate judge, there can be some important differences. I got to tell you, Tim, when I heard about the warrant, I thought, gee, I hope it's a district court judge that signed it, not a magistrate judge. And the reason why is, like, if you want to sneak by a warrant, you know, on like rule, you know, you're going to go to a magistrate judge, I think, more than a district court judge. So I
you know what I think
was.
Of just from a civilian standpoint, when I hear magistrate judge, I think, oh, he's a parking ticket judge.
Yeah.
Is that?
Well,
is that
yeah. And I mean, the other thing, too, is the guys. He was appointed by the judges in the circuit. Okay. So what happens is, while typically I think they'd be appointed by presidential nomination, the judges basically can get together and kind of say, we've got too much work and we need somebody else to handle the workload, literally the workload of the circuit. And so they can kind of hire a magistrate judge. And that's exactly what took place here. So, because, of course, I was thinking who appointed him to his judgeship, right? Well, the guy has a political appointment in his past, though, and it's to Clinton's Treasury Department. He was a Clinton appointee. He was like assistant secretary to the Treasury for Clinton for law enforcement. So you don't get that appointment unless you're a pretty good Democrat, is my mm-hmm. point. Now, I'm not saying that controls his issuance of this warrant, but I am saying that if we're looking to see who is directing these resources in action against Donald Trump, this is not a person who is apolitical
right.
in their
Well, this judge
past,
also
okay?
contributed.
This is a person who.
Didn't he contribute to the Obama campaign? I know he was linked to Obama in a couple of ways. And then, strangely enough, which strikes me as making a contribution so you can prove you're bipartisan after all this attachment to Clinton and Obama, he gave $500 to the Jeb Bush presidential campaign in 2016.
For a Floridian,
so
that's just probably
bipartisan.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Also, I heard that he was there were some stories that called him an associate of Epstein's because he had apparently represented
his pilots.
One of us. Yeah. And, you know, a lawyer represents clients and that has no bearing on who they yeah. may, you yeah. know, absent something other than the representation.
The Obama and Clinton you know. Thing is legitimate. The Epstein thing really doesn't seem like it
yeah.
is.
Well, we'll have some more to talk about this and other matters on next week's show. Thank you. Welcome back, and we'll look forward to the article you detailed appearing in this week's LibertyNation.com's offerings and many more. Thanks.
Thank you, Scott.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
That's it for this edition of The Uprising. Remember to hit Liberty Nation News for original articles, LN Radio, and our signature television program, The Conservative Five. Just go to LibertyNation.com on your browser or hit Rumble, YouTube, or check out our Liberty Nation News Roku channel. I'm Scott Cosenza. Thanks for watching. This program is a production of LibertyNation.com, conservative news where truth matters.
Contributor for LibertyNation.com.
I'm trying to make an impact. Liberty style. Fight for freedom.
Navy tracking poll sponsored by Liberty Nation for Thursday.
Mentioned by Dan Bongino, Rasmussen, Jordan Peterson, and others.
I'll do it again if you want me to.
Cited in Mark Levin's American Marxism.
I think we're starting to make a really big impact. Getting noticed. We're doing it.